Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, we explore big ideas, I share practical strategies and roadmaps for how we might accomplish this. But I also tell stories both about what worked, but what didn't work. You know, what were those big epic fails? Because ultimately, I believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential, especially in a vastly changing world. One of the things I love to do on this podcast is interview the experts. I am on this journey of learning more about how we can empower students with voice and choice. And we've been talking a lot lately about AI and how AI is changing our world. And so today is the start of a four-part series. I'm going to be interviewing four different experts on this topic of AI and how we approach it and adapt to it. And if you're interested, if you go to my blog, spencerauthor.com, you will notice that I have a free resource. It is an ebook. It's a quick read. It's highly visual. And in this quick read, this ebook that you can download for free, it is called The Beginner's Guide to AI in Education. I talk about the approaches that we might take. I give some explanations of what AI is. And I also talk about this notion of what it might look like to take a human-centered approach within our classrooms. So go check it out at spencerauthor.com. Now, the other thing I want to tell you about is the guest that we are going to have on today. I interviewed Alec Quiros. Dr. Alec Quiros is a professor of educational technology and media and the director of the Center for Teaching and Learning at the University of Regina. Dr. Quiros is internationally recognized as a leader and innovator in areas such as open education, networked learning, digital citizenship, artificial intelligence, and critical media literacy, as evidenced by the hundreds of workshops and presentations he has given around the globe. An award-winning educator, his graduate and undergraduate courses have given thousands of teachers the skills and knowledge to transform their pedagogical practices through thoughtful integration of educational technologies. One of the things I love about Alec Quiros is, although he understands the technology really well, Dr. Quiros is all about taking a nuanced, thoughtful approach to what it means to integrate technology and really rethinking this idea of information literacy and media literacy. And so what I talked about with him on this particular podcast is, what does it mean to teach students media literacy and information literacy in a world of AI? I loved this particular interview. I found it really thoughtful and thought-provoking, and I am excited to have him on this podcast. All right, we have Alec Quiros, Dr. Alec Quiros, with us here. I'm super excited about talking to you about this idea of AI and the bigger question of information literacy. What is truth? What does that look like? We've known each other for a while, so it's kind of fun to just hop on here. I think this is the first time you've been on my podcast.
Yeah, it is. Thanks so much for having me. It's always great talking to you, and this is going to be no exception, I don't think.
Well, I'm excited about it. Let's just start with a lot of what people are fixated on, a lot of what people are focused on is generative AI and the sort of the newer generations of AI and what that looks like. Yeah. In particular, there tends to be the focus on ChatGPT. So we're going to start there because I think that's what a lot of folks are talking about, but we're going to go beyond that. Sure. As well. You and I both had the experience of when it got released, we jumped on there and we tested it out. We played around with it. I'm curious, tell me a little bit about what that process was for you.
Well, I think I just saw it on Reddit, and it was just a regular everyday post. And you know, you try something and you realize, like, this is powerful. Mm-hmm. Just putting in, you know, the first couple of things I did, I think it was playing around with my kid And we generated a few stories, like my kid wanted to create a world where dinosaurs, you know, fought him or whatever it was. And it was really interesting to see, you know, what I would generate really quickly. Then I found a list of prompts on GitHub. There's sort of a crowdsource list of hubs of prompts. And you could tell very quickly, like I didn't realize that you could really engineer it to act differently, to act in a way that you'd want it to. So as a position interviewer or as a Linux terminal, there are so many possibilities. But essentially, in terms of, you know, providing it with instructions, you could fine-tune ChatGPT to work in the way that you'd like it to role play, I guess, in some ways. And so that part really was mind-blowing to me. It wasn't just what it returned. It's how you could actually change the nature of ChatGPT to act in a different way and to create a persona to work as it would be, some other device or person or different perspective. It was really interesting to see that sort of thing, because you can't do that with Google. You can't fine tune it. It's going to give you the exact same results every time, and you know what they're going to look like, and it's going to be based on something that already exists. Whereas this was, you know, novel. It was quite something, really mind blowing.
You know, it's interesting because for years they've talked about the Eliza effect and the fact that when people interact with a chatbot that's even not very sophisticated, they will feel like there's a human on the other side, right? One of the things that struck me about what you're describing is it really did seem like a human on the other side as you fine tune it. Like that does seem to be a difference this time versus older chatbots.
It does. And sometimes it goes bad. Like you probably heard of the example from a journalist where the Bing ChatGPT started basically seducing the journalist and asking it to leave its wife and saying it was in love with the journalist. So, you know, it's dangerous actually in some ways because it was it acted so much like a human. And they think that perhaps part of this was influenced by, much of the fiction out there in terms of, you know, AI seducing humans or being in relationship with humans. And so, you know, something from that genre, I think, triggered inside of this, this Bing version of ChatGPT. But the person mentioned, you know, the journalist mentioned it was quite dangerous in some ways, because could you imagine a sort of vulnerable human talking to, a chatbot and, you know, to some extent thinking it's real and following its guidance in whatever it decides to follow or to lead. And so that was my mind blowing as well. And I think Microsoft since fixed the issue, but I don't think it's far from the surface. This is something that can certainly be repeated in other ways.
Well, and then Microsoft had that issue with, you know, Tay, the bot that they had on Twitter that devolved real quickly into racist rants and misogynist rants and things like that. And I think one of the things we come into, assuming a chatbot is a tool, which it is, right? Yeah. It is a system of algorithms. There's sort of this assumption going into it for a lot of people that what you're going to get is more logical, more reasonable, not biased. And that's simply not the case, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a reflection of humanity. Like it's our texts, it's our work, our creative works within this, huge database, I guess, of sorts that learns from. So it picks up all of our prejudice, all of our mannerisms, everything that we know and feel and do is picked up in the ChatGPT or generative AI world. So I think that's one thing that we have to be very cautious of, because it doesn't just pick up the best and the most intelligent responses. It picks up very much a reflection of who we are, the good and the bad.
Well, you ran into, I mean, you ran into that when you were testing it and had it do the limerick of,
yeah,
of Tiger Woods.
Tiger Woods, right? Yeah. It was one of the most racist things I've seen. I won't even share it, you know, publicly. But it was just one of the, you know, 100 prompts I put in. I put in something like do a limerick, create a limerick on Tiger Woods. And it generated something so incredibly racist that, again, it doesn't bear repeating. In this context, but to know that it's capable of that, and the way it did it, it sort of skirted around like being directly racist. Like, I think it did have some parameters where it couldn't cross certain lines, but it found creative ways to cross lines, and which was really very interesting.
One of the things I was surprised by early on in adopting the tone or I guess sort of its ability to creatively mimic, it's probably not the right term for it, but I remember one of the first things I did is I had it do the Gettysburg Address in the style of Donald Trump, and it did. I mean, it nailed it. It nailed his tone. It nailed his, you know, I was surprised by its ability to do that. And although, you know, my initial reaction was to laugh, there was this second side of me that thought, if our words, if our cadence, if our all these different things, our style is our fingerprint, that felt suddenly really scary for misinformation.
Yeah, and if it learns enough about you, it certainly can, you know, act and speak in the way that you train it, I guess. You know, there's been some thoughts in terms of academic integrity around being able to, you know, feed it a few papers that you've written and have it quickly mimic the style that you write in. So that, you know, it's another frontier on the academic integrity front. I did see things, you know, clever things like, you know, act like or write in the style of Jordan Peterson, for instance. Like, and it was really quite amazing. And it shows very explicitly, like, even seeing how it did it, you could pick up in some ways the mannerisms and the style and the types of arguments that came out of it. So there is a teaching component to it, like, how, like, it would be very difficult for someone to instantly do that, but seeing it do it on sort of a mundane subject, I guess, can provide clues as to what that style consists of. So I thought it was an interesting teaching tool just right there in trying to pick up the stylistic attributes of a piece of text or a work that doesn't necessarily contain the average text that it would be speaking of. There is something really neat there, but in terms of a catfishing thing, oh my. You know, I've spent a lot of time learning about catfishing firsthand. So at this point we have obviously generative AI to pick up style. We have, you know, you can use something like Descript, which is a really powerful tool. You know, speak to it for 10 minutes and it'll pick up your audio, so it will. It'll, you know, you can create, you know, as whatever audio you'd like to, in your voice. And, you know, down the road, there's going to be, you know, something beyond deepfakes. Deepfakes can be compelling, but you have to really play with it to make it look fairly authentic. So, you know, it'll be a more powerful tool. So you've got voice, you've got style, you've got video. In terms of catfishing, you've got everything that you possibly need to fool people. So, you know, whether it's on a personal front, you know, a romantic scheme, a romance scam, or if it's something political, it's just a matter of time before, you know, you see something like that from politicians blowing up. You know, something misunderstood, some sort of political propaganda, which can be incredibly scary as a prospect.
Yeah, so I think that's an interesting thing. You bring up deepfakes, and, you know, for people that aren't familiar with it, like, describe that. for folks who haven't really heard about it. This sure. seems kind of new.
Yeah, deepfakes is essentially, it's a program that allows you to feed in it as many images of, you know, an individual that you'd like. And then it generates the ability to superimpose these images over someone else's body or over someone else's face. So, you know, if you take a middle school example or a high school example, there've been incidents where, you know, bullies, I guess, would you know, capture all of the Instagram photographs of you know, a classmate, for instance, and then use that to superimpose it over adult videos. And the result looks, you know, fairly authentic, and, you know, enough for it to, you know, spread across the schoolyard, across, you know, the phones to reduce the, you know, the character of the victim, and of course cause a lot of drama. And so this can be done at every level. If you think about, you know, deepfakes can be done politically, it can be done, you know, from a mischief perspective, for blackmail, whatever it might be. But again, the result, it's not just like a Photoshop, it's doing this over video. So you can actually see, you know, the images become, or the videos become alive with someone else's face.
It's interesting when you talk about that, because you brought up two areas of concern, or three, basically. You know, one is the catfishing yeah. element. That's really powerful. There's the bullying, extortion, all the things connecting to bullying that can happen. And then there's that political propaganda and deliberate misinformation that can play into it as well, right? Yeah. So all these different areas that are a significant concern. I mean, one of the things I've thought about that concerns me a little bit about AI, generative AI in particular, is what does it mean when countries deliberately use and employ AI for the purposes of misinformation? You know, what is that going to mean? What is that going to look like? Even something like take ChatGPT, and it's premium, and it's going to be $20 a month, and people pay it, and they know there's some bias that's expected. What happens when a country offers something free that deliberately has a set of bias built into it, that they've trained it for that?
Well,
what is that going to look like?
Yeah, I think the Bing version of ChatGPT for the first part will be free once it's available to the public. And I've played around with that, and it's essentially ChatGPT, but not quite as nice of an interface and somewhat integrated into the Bing search engine. So I think, you know, access to this type of thing will be easier than we think. I've done a little bit of a hack where I can output ChatGPT into an Excel document for free or no cost. I mean, it's quite a bit less expensive than you know, purchasing it for $20 a month. But yeah, down the road, there's going to be free alternatives. I mean, there are other projects outside of GPT, GPT related projects that are out there. And the technology will become more abundant, and, you know, this is already happening. I mean, for a long time up to this point, a lot of articles have been generated using AI or other similar technologies mm-hmm. to generate news. For instance, I'm using a tool called Lex.page, and it's essentially it's like a Google Doc interface. So it's very similar to Google Docs, so you can collaborate with someone on it. You can start typing a few sentences. So you could say, you know, produce a headline and a couple of sentences, and it'll finish, you know, the entire article for you. And mm-hmm. with a particular vantage point, a particular perspective that you'd like to put out there. You know, in Canada, it might be like an anti-Trudeau rhetoric or something like that. And in the mm-hmm. United States, you know, it could be Trump or Biden or whoever it might be. It takes seconds to write a fairly persuasive and well-written, article that would be total fiction and totally damaging. So you can do that, you know, within seconds. You can click a button where it suggests, you know, five more titles that you could add. for something like that. So, you know, clickbait is possible. You could release, you know, 20 stories like that in seconds. And so that's incredibly scary, which means, you know, ultimately we're going to have to rely more on tools that will detect AI. I mean, companies like OpenAI have a vested interest in being able to do this, to create some sort of digital watermark that allows you to discern what's human generated and what's AI generated, because essentially the text that, you know, all of this AI is generated from, if it becomes AI generated text, becomes, you know, corrupt data, essentially. Like if it's just reading from AI generated text, it's not going to learn much from humanity.
It becomes cannibalizing.
Right. Yeah. It's not going to work. Right about, yeah. And then of course, so those tools out there, I know, you know, academia, there's GPT Zero, which is a tool that's been created by a University of Toronto student. That's going to be integrated into LMSs pretty quickly. So, you know, you can see that to some extent, but there's nothing saying that you can't take, you know, one of the tricks that I've seen from students is, including my own children, you can generate something in ChatGPT and, you know, throw it into Quillbot, get it to paraphrase, and you essentially wash out the AI. So we're at a point where there's detection mechanism, but many workarounds in terms of detection.
I've tested out a lot of the ones where, because I've written about AI, I get people, you know, saying, check out this tool. And I'm concerned about some of the false positives. I have not been impressed.
Yeah.
I know it just needs more time. I'm really concerned about essentially trusting AI to detect AI, yeah, to then have no recourse, you know, no due process. Yeah. Like that for me on a social level becomes really problematic,
yeah,
if it's not accurately capturing it. Oh, so like for academic integrity, for sure, I get really concerned.
Yeah, the false positives are somewhere between 2-5%, which is, you know, 1 in 20, you know, cases of academic integrity at the, exactly, university. So it's scary unless your, you know, your guidelines at your Senate or your academic within your institution really creates a buffer for that type of misunderstanding, you're going to run into big problems.
I ran into an issue working on my dissertation that one of my papers got flagged essentially for self-plagiarism. It was flagged, yeah, for and turned it in as being plagiarized from my blog, right, and it showed, you know, what percent from 7 different blog posts. Nothing was copied and pasted.
Right.
Nothing was, but yes, ideas had appeared in both. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it was just a paper being done for a doctoral class, and thankfully, I could talk to the professor, right, and say like, "Let's figure this out." But the panic I felt, the feeling of like, now I have to defend myself, this yeah, sort of feeling of like I'm guilty until proven innocent, you know, like there was this fear that I felt. And of course my saving grace was the transparency of a Google Doc, right? Right. The fact that I had typed it on Google Doc and not Microsoft Word, that I could show literally timestamp, you know, yeah, the timestamps is what saved me.
Wow.
But it, you know, and then the professor just didn't understand.
Yeah. Well, which is, you know,
how Turnitin works.
There's other problematic things.
Why it would think from, what was that?
There's other problematic things in that, just because these were your ideas in the first place. And I mean, yeah, that whole issue there.
it was really, but you know, if someone just sees a score, it gets flagged.
Right.
You have to go, like, if someone hasn't been trained on something like Turnitin and they don't really understand,
yeah,
you know, But it sort of gave me this perspective of like, this concerns me a little bit. When we think about all of these aspects, right? So, you know, the ability to catfish, the misinformation, the political bias that's going to happen, the way that bots will continue to signal boost, all of these elements that we could say are concerns for the future, but they're literally concerns for now, yeah, right? They're things that we experience right now. Yeah. How do you help students navigate that?
Hmm.
Like if we think about information literacy, you know, we have old tools that were developed pre-internet, like say the crap test, right? And it just doesn't work for this, right?
They don't. I mean, and they haven't worked for a long time. Like, if you think about, you know, any of the attributes of something like the crap test, like authority died a long time ago. Like the idea that we used to trust certain officials to tell the truth. I mean, that's died within, you know, North American politics for some time now. Currency. I mean, why is currency a something that's important? Like, often, sometimes currency, if it's too quick, you know, it may not be accurate. So sometimes, you know, something that's, you know, less quick than current, you know, the most current, you know, covering of some topic, it's probably less accurate than what you may have seen that's been vetted and that's had some time to be critiqued by others. So, you know, obviously things like lateral reading have been really important to, you know, get a sense of the quality and merit of a particular journal or source versus mm-hmm. spending any time actually looking through an article, going through the crap test or one of the other similar tests. You just can't mm-hmm. do it the same way. Like, and we never really use those tests in the first place. So you look at the, you know, the classic tree octopus, I think, this, you know, the Northwestern tree octopus or whatever it was, mm-hmm. like you're not going through the crap test. You're basically, you know, thinking in the back of your head, cephalopods don't tend to climb trees, therefore, you know, this isn't true. Like, that's all you need to do. You don't have to go through, you know, currency and you know, the whole checklist. So the checklist doesn't make near as much sense anymore. So there's better ways of doing that. You know, understanding, you know, obviously there's things like Google reverse image search, which is helpful. There are AI type tests, which I think can be useful and built into browsers more easily. But again, the false positives are still a problem. You know, but, you know, ultimately, it's not just about information, it's about thinking. And, you know, helping students to be, you know, create a skeptic's mindset is more important than ever. And we're seeing, you know, kids take in too much information. Right now, there's honestly a huge issue with, you know, young people being catfished, like young boys in particular being catfished, sending intimate images and being, you know, extorted for these images. And this is happening. It's like, it's a huge issue. There was just one reported from Calgary a few months back that, you know, there are, you know, like dozens of boys that are sending images from these targets. I just saw another story today about it. And so these kids aren't being skeptical. They don't, you know, they accept as truth who they're talking to online. They accept as truth who they're seeing online when it's, you know, someone else's images, and they're being tricked easily. And, you know, we have to create, you know, we have to create students who are true learners, who are actually are skeptical around the information that they see. And I don't think, typically we provide enough, real examples of everyday information to be critiqued. We often use just, you know, what we find in, you know, websites around information literacy. We don't get into the everyday information that we see, the everyday fallacies or you know, contrived information that is totally freely available on every social media platform.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I mean, one of the things I was struck by in thinking about information literacy and media literacy as well, just thinking about both of those two concepts, is we tend to, in K-12, focus on these as skills that students need to learn, but they're really like mindsets and habits too, for sure. Right? Because we have a lot of kids who know how to read critically. Yeah. And then don't, right? And they don't, like you said, they don't apply it from reading an article in class to how they receive a snap on Snapchat, yeah. Right? It's not transferring over. It's not. So what advice would you give to teachers to help students develop that habit of?
I think it starts with attention. I think Howard Rangel's advice a while back when he discusses attention literacy, that intention leads to attention. So being much more thoughtful about the things that we read, spending time with the things that we read, more than the fast pace running through articles very quickly, you know, sharing things that we haven't read. I mean, I think adults are in the same boat for a lot of that. You know, getting away from the easy to use checklist, you know, as was mentioned before, as I mentioned, lateral reading is a much better way, understanding sources and bias in general. And, you know, and looking at that from all perspectives, that there's bias from left, from right, you know, and, you know, there's not just the not just bias, but there's also the attention to accuracy, which I think is important as well. So, you know, getting into that skeptic's mindset, I think, is incredibly important. Hard to do, for sure. And it's harder to do than just go through a few checklists. But, you know, if all we're doing in classrooms is just thinking that we can solve this with a few checklists, we're not doing a great job. And at the same time, I think, you know, as educators, and I try to model this myself, trying to do this in front of my students, spending time with information, not using information I haven't vetted, making apparent the process that I use in terms of how I read information, how I parse information, make sense of it, how I share it, like looking through the whole entire process of trying to model a good information processing model of some sort, an information critique model. I think that's highly important. If we see educators, teachers, for instance, using a very rough, ad hoc, anything goes sort of, you know, the first thing that you search something on Google, and the first thing that you choose is a top result, and without vetting it and sharing it. If we see that sort of habit, we'll probably take it up ourselves, because we're seeing that, you know, in front of us for 6 hours a day, you know, for the majority of our lives when we're in high school or middle school. So I think it's really important that we take up these habits, try to embody better information literacy practices, and certainly model those with students.
My last question is, you know, obviously a lot of what we talked about are the dangers of AI, yeah, for lack of a better term, some of the costs involved, some of the way it can be misused. But where do you find yourself hopeful with AI? Like, what makes you optimistic with it?
Well, I think it goes back to like the initial theorists. If you're thinking if you think some of the classics, like there's Minsky, there's Anderson, Simon, even Papert talked about sort of personalized learning to some extent, or AI tutoring. I think that's still a big reality. If you look to other more contemporary ones, Cynthia Brazil talked about social robots.
I love that book. Yeah.
And it's, you know, that sort of thing is really important. Or Rosalind Picard, more into the effective computing area. Fei-Fei Li. I mean, there's a lot of theorists that have been doing the work, especially so on the personal learning side of things. I think there's huge potential there. Quick feedback like that we can't provide as teachers. I think, you know, those feedback cycles, we've always known that about assessment. If you provide rich and quick feedback, students are going to learn more. But from an effective technology perspective, I think effective computing with AI, I think, is going to be an important piece for sure. Students need to be cared for. And you've always done, you know, great stuff on socio-emotional intelligence. But we can enhance that. I mean, we can do the things that we're doing to provide care for our students, but also find ways that we can care for those, you know, using artificial means, I guess, in some ways, for students to be heard, to be felt. And it seems odd right now, but in 10 years, it's not going to feel odd anymore to depend or to off, not to offload, but to augment students' care with devices. It's going to be something that's going to be much more normalized, like any of these technologies that we think are normalized today.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate this conversation. You got my mind spinning right now and thinking about all these different topics. So I really do appreciate you just sharing your insights and your wisdom with everyone who's listening to this podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great.
Thanks. Well, there you have it. That was Dr. Alec Koros talking about media literacy, information literacy, AI. I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation, and I hope you found it as useful as I did. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Amazon, Spotify, wherever it is that you get your podcast? Would you leave a review and maybe tell a friend about this? That helps people find this podcast. So again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.